Welcome to Changing Academic Life. I'm Geraldine Fitzpatrick, and this is a podcast series where academics and others share their stories, provide ideas, and provoke discussions about what we can do individually and collectively to change academic life for the better.
Because there's a huge range of different roles where people can stay in touch with research, use these other skills that they've got, and actually potentially build a more fulfilled, happier, more stable life for themselves.
Yes. That's the voice of Dr. Sarah McCluskey, who has done just that for her own life as a freelancer, where, to quote from her website, she helps research organisations share their brilliant work through events and communications that connect and inspire. And you can hear the energy with which she does that work in our conversation here. What she also does is host the Research Adjacent podcast. And we start off in this conversation exploring diverse career paths that are available in research adjacent type roles. I love the way she talks about research as a team sport, and she highlights the whole range of skills and expertise that are needed to make research happen. We then go on to talk about Sarah's own journey from her PhD into her research adjacent role as the freelancer supporting events and communication. And it was interesting to see the way that the seeds for that were already evident as a PhD student in what she volunteered for and what she loved doing. And then in the third part of our conversation, we focus specifically on Sarah's areas of expertise as a research adjacent person herself. She had some really insightful things to share around the importance of gathering with purpose and how to practically enable good conversations when we do get together. A big aha for me was how she talked about the importance of preparing the participants to participate, not just preparing them for the logistics of the event. And she also talks about some of her work around communicating with purpose as well. It's a really fascinating conversation on so many levels, and I hope you enjoy it.
So, Sarah McCluskey, thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to talk to you because I think you are such an advocate and a role model for there being more to life post-PhD than the traditional working in academia or working in industry type paths.
Oh, thank you. Well, thank you so much for having me, and very kind to describe me as a role model. I do what I can, but certainly doing what I can to advocate for all the people that go into making research successful. And it is a much wider picture than just what we think of as academics and researchers. And that's what I'm really interested in. Yeah.
And it just opens up so many more options for people to think about. I want to come to the role model bit soon. If we can start off at the advocacy bit, because one of the things that you've done, or how I first became more aware of your work, was your podcast called Research Adjacent. My ulterior motive is that I teach a PhD course where we end up thinking about careers, with them having spent a lot of time during the semester thinking about what are they really good at, what do they love doing, what are their strengths, what are their values, and then trying to think about career options, not from the label, but more how it connects to who they are at their best. Mm. And so my ulterior motive is picking your brains about what are the different options that you've seen in the people that you've talked to. But first of all, your research adjacent label, that's a really interesting label. Do you want to unpack that?
Yeah, sure. And I mean, I think where it all came about was actually quite similar to what you've just described there. I have done, through my career, lots and lots of jobs where I have worked alongside researchers in some capacity. And in some of the most recent ones, I was working with PhD students, ECRs, having lots of conversations with them about where they were going to go in the future and what their future career might be. And sometimes they were coming to talk to me because I was just somebody who wasn't their supervisor, somebody who could give them a little bit of advice. Sometimes they were coming to talk to me because they wanted help with funding applications, things like that, job applications. And sometimes I was actually put in positions of organizing things. So where the title Research Adjacent came from was because I was asked to organize a careers panel for some ETR students on a project I was working on. And I had to, and they wanted non-traditional careers or non-academic careers, I can't remember what they called it. And I just needed something to call it. And then I just remembered that I had on Twitter seen somebody say like hashtag research adjacent. And I went, oh, that's really good. I could use that. And the reason I liked research adjacent is because the world of research, making research happen, is so much bigger than just the people who are in the lab, in the library, whatever they're doing, working on their research on their computer. And that can't happen without a huge range of other people. And whether that is people doing roles like what I've done for most of my career, which is around events, communication, engagement, that sort of thing. We need project managers. We need the people in the research office who are dealing with the funding. There might be people who are business partnerships, knowledge exchange people. There are trainers who are organizing all this training for ECRs. There's just such a huge range of people involved. And because I'd come from working in those roles, I always had a slight allergy to being called admin or support because it felt slightly derogatory with respect to the contributions that I was making. So I liked adjacent because it had this sense of being on a level, on a kind of beside, but not subservient to, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because the support label or the admin label puts it as a, I don't know, second class citizen or in service of the grand master, the grand researcher.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people I've spoken to, they're happy to be their work to be described as being in service of the research and in support of the research. Mm. But the idea that they are somehow there, that there's like some professor on a pedestal and it's their job to just like do whatever they're told to support them. That's where people get very twitchy. And that is also where people have had some quite bad treatment as well. So I often describe research as a team sport, and you need a huge team of people in order to make it successful. And increasingly, I think as we go into the future, that's becoming more and more important. And not just collaborations across interdisciplinary teams, but also all these specialist report roles, support roles. So you've got software engineers, technicians, all these people who, specialist librarians, you know, publishing experts, open research experts. We can't expect academics to understand all of these things. They need to be good at doing the research part, but they need to know and draw on the services that are available of all these other people.
Yeah, yeah. And it's about having people who are best at these sorts of roles playing those roles, because part of your thing about team sport, and I love that analogy, is you need people who are best suited to different positions in the team for the sport. And
yeah, and that absolutely matters. It does. It really does. And it's only if you are getting the best from everybody that you get that. Well, I mean, there's a whole research culture conversation going on in the UK at the moment, and the timing of this conversation just happening announced these changes to the REF. But that,
and the REF
sense
being the research,
the research assessment framework, excellence framework thing. Yes. So, but research increasingly, there's a conversation in the UK around research culture and the fact that if you maybe you can grind out what you might consider excellent research, you know, that gets in all the highly cited journals and that sort of thing. Maybe you can just grind out by brute force and, you know, flogging people to get there. Yeah. But who wants to work in that culture? What people actually want is a culture where everybody's working together, it's more collaborative, and everybody is drawing on what they're best at and what their skills yeah. are, and yeah. using that towards a common good. And often, and I think this shift in emphasis away from things like publications and more to that sense of what is the common good? What is the difference that we're trying to make through this research? Mm. And the more we think about that, the more we can get on board with this research culture conversation, I think.
Yeah. And the different contributions that mm. go to making up a good research team.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the ones that I've seen, the teams that I've worked on with academics who were really at the top of their game and making a real difference mm-hmm. are the ones where they did treat everybody well and drew on everybody's yeah. skills and, yeah. and understood the contributions that yeah. different people could make and how valuable yeah. that could be.
And that's a key part, isn't it, Sarah? Like that understanding the contributions and valuing them.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And there's, I think we've gone through, there was a bit of a phase in the kind of 2010s, I've been around this world for a long time, where there was this expectation that academics would do everything. You know, they'd have to be excellent at their research and also doing public engagement and also doing business collaborations and also doing all the admin and all the teaching. And I think everybody, absolutely justifiably, academics went, this is too much. Yeah. We need to kind of, you can't expect, there's very, very few people, I don't know if there's anybody who's good at all of those things. So you need to pull back and you need to draw in people who can bring mm. those yeah. different skills to the table.
So if we accept that, mm. and you know, I'm a flag-waving yeah. supporter of that model, I'm also aware that we don't really have the career paths and structures for people so far to do that. And I'm just thinking, for example, of one particular student in the class who is finishing up his PhD soon, and he said that what he really loves doing, what he's realizing through his PhD, is he loves taking complex data and visualizing it. And that's what his real passion is. Like the research that he's communicating is it's interesting, but it's the that passion of the representation of yeah. the data.
Yeah.
And where would I point him to look for what his options might be, or how would you talk to someone about that?
Yeah, I mean, that you're right that there aren't structured career paths for a lot of these things. Mm. And partly it's because a lot of them haven't. I mean, the idea of an academic has been around for a very long time, hundreds yeah. of years probably, whereas some of these other roles are quite new. As you say, this idea of visualizing data, visualizing information, you know, 20 years ago, maybe there was an idea of somebody being like a textbook illustrator or something yeah. like that. But really, yeah. things have kind of grown now. And actually, they are, even publishers are looking at ways of presenting information in different formats and stuff like that. So there's become much more of a push towards taking information, making it visual, mm. sharing it in different sorts of ways. So a lot of these jobs are new jobs, and that's mm. why there aren't career structures in it. Yeah. It's also why a lot of organizations like universities, research institutes, companies even, aren't necessarily employing people like that full time or putting in place job structures for them. In that specific example that you've given there, the likelihood is they would probably need to be freelance. The way yeah. things currently stand, they might find that someone like a publisher would be looking for those kind of skills. But increasingly, again, like the companies, they'll use freelancers as well. But mm-hmm. yeah, that specific yeah. example, I would probably advise them to yeah. do, just practice their skills and yeah. build up a portfolio and go that way. But I do realize that that is a very unsatisfying answer for somebody who has invested so much in their career mm. up to this point. Mm. And I know that that is one of the biggest challenges that comes up when I talk to PhD students or even mm. ECRs who are thinking about what they do next, is that it's this what they call sunk cost fallacy, where mm. they've put so much into doing the PhD and there is this sense that, you know, particularly sometimes it comes from other people, like your family and everything. They'll be like, oh, you're doing a PhD, so of course you're going to become like a professor. That's what you do. You do PhD and follow that through. The reality is the statistics vary for different subjects, but typically only about 25% of PhD graduates will stay in academia for any length of time. Yeah. And it's more like about 10% will become full professors. So that's 75% of people who are going somewhere else, they're going to do something else. And so one of the biggest challenges here is that mindset issue. It's that, who am I if I'm not an academic? It has all this time and effort been wasted if I don't follow an academic career? You know, don't I owe it to myself or owe it to my family or whoever's been kind of bankrolling this to try and force it for a while? And I've worked with so many people who are just miserably kind of clinging on to this idea that this is who they are and this is what they have to do. That it makes me really sad sometimes. And that, again, is one of the reasons behind why I wanted to start the podcast and why I wanted to showcase the opportunities out there, because there's a huge range of opportunities, huge range of different roles where people can stay in touch with research, use these other skills that they've got, and actually potentially build a more fulfilled, happier, more stable life for themselves.
That mindset piece is so important, and it goes to both, I think, what the individual can do to go, actually, these are the things that really light me up, that I really like about what I'm doing. And even if you're not directly using your research, it's not wasted, because you have an understanding of the context and the way that your passion can contribute. That's invaluable. And it also points to the really important role that everyone in the ecosystem can play, can't they, in not perpetuating the mindset that this is the only path. You're an academic, all well if you don't make it. Because, as you said, the reality is there aren't the positions, full stop.
Yeah. And I think, and it is, I really feel for some people who are in situations where maybe their supervisor or somebody that's around them is making them feel like a failure if they don't either want to pursue this, to pursue an academic route, or if they try and they just can't get the funding, they're not getting the jobs, and they can really be made to feel like a failure. And that's just, I think, again, it comes back to this research culture piece, doesn't it? It comes back to that understanding in the supervisors that that there aren't enough jobs in the system, and that their job is to prepare the students for the next phase of their career, whatever that is, without that attachment, actually, I think, to what it is. You know, my mum said to me once about being a parent, she said, there's not many jobs where, if you're doing it right, you put yourself out of a job. And it's almost a bit like that, I think, with PhD providers as well, is you have to, your job is to prepare them to go, you know, and go and be who they're going to be.
We also need changes at institutional levels as well, you're making me think, because sometimes part of your success as a research leader or supervisor is how many of your students have gone to, I don't know, a top level institution as a professor, as a or the marker of success. Yeah. And we've got to change that, because going back to your piece about the importance of the culture and the team sport, it's all the contributions are really important.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really problematic about using those metrics, like, you know, what that one individual person's career trajectory has been, or what the, you know, one specific research publication, and because it neglects all the other people that have gone to getting that person to that point.
Yeah.
And you can't draw a line to say that you did that, because lots of people did that. It's not like it's one thing. So it's a really unhelpful metric. I think
in opening up the possibilities for people, you listed off earlier in the conversation a whole range of different roles that are way beyond what people normally think about, because I think the rhetoric is often, you know, you're an academic position or an industry research. Mm-hmm. In all of the people that you've spoken to for the podcast, are there any particular themes or patterns that you see in how they've moved into these positions or...
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So I think I tend to think about, although there's a huge range of opportunities out there, I think people don't realize just how many opportunities there are out there. I tend to think of them in four main categories, which might be quite useful for people. So one of them is kind of professional roles, which are in research services, as it were. Mm-hmm. So that's things like people who work in the research office, who deal with grants and finance and that sort of thing. It also includes people who do the legal and intellectual property side of things. It includes publishing. It includes the kind of mechanics of doing research. Yeah. So I think of that as kind of research professional services. Then there is a lot of roles around training and development. So that is, you know, supporting the next generation of researchers coming through the system. And there's, again, different in different countries, but in the UK, there's a whole structured program that goes into professional development for PhD students and early career researchers. Then you have got people whose fundamental role is doing communications and engagement. So that is taking the research and sharing it beyond the university. So whether that's working with patients and public collaborators on the research, whether it's working in partnership with policymakers, whether it's more your kind of traditional science journalism side of things, which has actually died for a while, but it's coming back a bit now. So there's the communications and engagement piece. And then there is what are sometimes called knowledge brokers, intermediaries, people who are managing relationships. So they're looking at things like research impact, knowledge exchange, partnerships with businesses, partnerships with other collaborators, charities, you know, things like that, whoever it might be, public sector organizations. So I tend to think of these jobs as being in those four categories there.
That's really interesting.
And I think to go back to your original question about the patterns of how people have ended up in these roles, I think there is almost all the people I speak to have done a PhD. And I should say, actually, these roles, you absolutely don't need a PhD to do them. I'd say about 50% of the people I've interviewed on the podcast have got PhDs, but some of them have got specialist qualifications in other areas. So, for example, a couple that spring to mind, I've had some people on the podcast who work in archives and they've got specialist archive qualifications. I've got some people, and librarian as well, specialist librarian qualifications. I've had on an exhibition curator who specializes in research-based exhibitions. Obviously, his background is all in curation and the arts and exhibitions and things like that. So you absolutely don't need a PhD, but having a PhD can be really helpful. And often people who have got a PhD, when I speak to them, they will say either one of two things. Either they got to the end of their PhD and there just weren't any jobs, so they had to look
pragmatic
at what else was out there. Yeah. So it's pragmatic. Or it might be things like, there's quite a common story of people who, for some reason, often because they were a partner of an academic, I could go down that line, but that'll take us in a whole other direction, and found themselves in a place where they had to find a job.
Yeah.
And they just looked at what was around, maybe in a university city, what are the jobs that seem to match my skills? And they've ended up looking at jobs in the university, not academics. Yeah. So often it's because just a pragmatic choice, you know, what's out there that could be a good fit for my skills. Or the other one is people who followed a more passion-led route. Mm-hmm. So they've gone through their PhD and they've just been like that example of that student you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. They've just been like, what I love is this kind of visual communication side of things. And I really want to go down that route. So it seems to, it's usually one of those two things. Yeah.
Yeah. And I said at the beginning that you're a role model yourself for moving into a research adjacent role. What was your motivation? Because you did a PhD
in the 90s.
Yeah, you did a PhD in plant biochemistry.
I did. Yeah. So I did a PhD partly because I got to the end of my degree and I just didn't, I still didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up. I still don't quite know what I want to do when I grew up.
I know that feeling.
Even though I'm in my 50s now. But then I got to the end of the PhD, and in the process of doing that, I realized that I love science. I really, really just found it really interesting. I loved lab work. I was not great at the writing up side of things and the paper side of things. That wasn't a strength. I love teaching. So if I could have, you know what I mean? So there were some of the things were a good fit and some things just weren't. And I just wasn't, I was looking at jobs and I did apply for some jobs in industry and things like that, where there was less of the pressure to publish. But actually at the same time I was doing that, whilst I was doing my PhD, it was just when science communication was starting to become a bit more of a thing. And during my PhD, there were just opportunities to go on little training courses and write articles for like science communication writing competitions. And I started doing some little bits of that. I was also running events at the Students' Union whilst I was doing my PhD as well.
That you volunteered for?
That I just volunteered for.
Which is interesting to pay attention to what you volunteer for.
Absolutely. So I volunteered doing that. I was volunteering doing, whilst I was writing on my PhD, I volunteered doing schools stuff at the Botanic Gardens, you know, all sorts of stuff like that. So yeah, I was volunteering to run events in the Students' Union. I was volunteering to help out with schools visits at the local Botanic Gardens. And with all that volunteering experience, those courses and things I'd done, whilst I was writing up my PhD and applying for proper jobs, I started doing some work in science communication. So I took a short-term contract for the Edinburgh Science Festival, where I was going around schools and doing, like, you know, demos and workshops and things like that. And then I got a job as front of house, which is just like the lowest paid minimum wage, but in a science centre as well, whilst I was applying for jobs and writing up a PhD. And then I got to a point, so I'd finished writing up and I was just applying for loads of different jobs. And in the same week, I had an offer of an interview at AstraZeneca pharmaceutical company for a proper research job. And I had an interview to be an education officer at Science Centre in Newcastle. I'm still in Newcastle 25 years later, which tells you which option I took. And it was down to, it's a combination of the skills thing and the pragmatic thing. The AstraZeneca job was in the south of England. People listening might not know my accent, depending, but I'm from Scotland originally. And I didn't want to go to the south of England, so I took the job in Newcastle and then ended up going down that route of science communication, science education. I did that for a long time. I was only actually at that first job for about 18 months, but then went into a university and was working alongside a lot of researchers, helping them to talk about the research they were doing in a way that made sense to young people, in a way that was exciting and interesting to young people. I then went on from there to do other stuff like big events with schools, getting lots of research volunteers in to come and help out. I was actually an actual college lecturer for a few years. I worked for a learned society and eventually ended up going into, my most recent employed jobs were in a university as a project manager for a research project, but actually doing all their events and communications and engagement. And so that is how I ended up kind of going down that route there. And I'm now, again, when we talked about challenges with career structure and progression and things like that, I had got to a point in the university where any promotions, I got a promotion, I tried it out. It was a very bureaucratic job. And it was lots of HR and budgets and health and safety when I like the doing of the stuff. Yeah. And so I realized that really my only option at that point was to go self-employed, which is what I did. And I've been for four years now. So, yeah.
So I really love the way, even though you said that there was some pragmatics involved in the decision about taking that first Newcastle job, you'd been walking the talk. Yeah. You know, when you look back, the seeds were there, the threads were really clear in where you naturally oriented to, what you naturally seem to love doing and would spend your time on. I think they're just such big pointers for us. And that then the rational voice in the head, you know, you use the language of proper job. Maybe we have to trust ourselves more and pay attention to where we naturally orient and just tell that proper voice about the proper job to, you know, go back in its box for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's always finding that balance, isn't it? Because I've been somebody, I'm from a relatively, not massively privileged background, but I've always had to work. So even when, and I'm always very aware of that, is that, yes, I was able to follow my interest, and I've always... Like, to anybody who's worrying that they don't have like a 10-year plan or something like that, I've never had a plan. It's always been, what's the next opportunity that seems interesting? And what's the next best move for me? And by doing that, I have managed to always be employed and always managed to find something to do. And sometimes those decisions have been led by something that I really, really wanted to do. Sometimes it's been very pragmatic decisions. So, for example, the reason that I was freelance before and then went back into work because I had a young child, and just the logistics of managing school drop-offs and, you know, consistent income and needing to provide for the family just didn't work very well with being freelance. And so sometimes... But I think I've managed to keep, and there's times when I've made choices, like I said, with that, when I took that job that was very bureaucratic and wasn't a great fit. I worked with lovely people, just in case they're listening. I love the people that I worked with. They were great. It was the job that wasn't a great fit for me. And sometimes you do that, but you just have, it's having the trust in yourself to say, that's okay. I can go and do something else. It's not the end of the world. And just trusting that you can figure it out. I think so many people worry that they'll never get another job, or they'll never, you know, they can't do anything else, or they can't, you know. And it is tough out there. The way I walked into jobs in science communication 25 years ago doesn't happen now. I'm very, very aware of that. People now, like back then, you couldn't even do a master's in science communication, whereas now often that's expected, and then lots of voluntary experience, and that does make it more challenging for some people to get that foot in the door. But the main thing I always say to people and all the young people I've worked with over the years, you always have options. There's always something. There's always like a little, you know, if the plan A doesn't work out, what's the plan B or the plan C, or, you know, you're never tied to one thing forever.
Yes. Yeah. And the being brave enough when it's not working out to go stop, because it's your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your passion. So you, now you're doing your freelance work. You clearly bring such huge diverse experience right back from the 90s, 2000s in both the science communications and running the sort of science related events. Can you talk a little bit more about what you're doing? So one, I love on your website, when you talk about events, you talk about gathering with purpose.
Yeah.
And I don't know that I've ever heard that sort of language talked about in relation to science research events.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, again, it's a bit like the research adjacent. It was just like one day I was like, what am I going to call? You know, I was like, oh, I'm getting a new newsletter. What am I going to call it? It's like, oh, that's good. Yeah. On a walk. Things always come to me on walks. So one of the things that happens if you become freelance, if anybody's thinking about going freelance, is that you have to sort of pull all those threads of what you've done together and construct a bit of identity around what you can offer to the world, so that you can tell people about it, so people know what to come to you for and what to refer people to you for. And I think when I first became freelance, I just did very generally, you know, work around research, communications, engagement events. So a broad range of things. But I started to realize, and I think with doing the podcast as well, is what I'm really good at doing is getting people talking to each other.
Oh, lovely.
And there's all kinds of situations in the research world where we need to be having better conversations. I think some of it is around public engagement, patient involvement, stakeholder engagement. So some of it is around bringing together those different worlds of people to have better conversations about research and about the difference that it makes to them. I think increasingly, as I said, we're having interdisciplinary collaborations. So it's bringing people together across different subject areas, different people who might think their research is not connected at all, bringing them together and helping them to have conversations that help to move the research forwards. And then the other thing that I really care about is now that is making things like conferences and meetings better. So since COVID, and you know, online communication technology is amazing. The fact that Geraldine, you and I are able to have this conversation, even though we're in different countries and different time zones, and you know, is brilliant. And I think that people being able to work from home is making a huge difference to a lot of people's lives. But what is becoming much more challenging, and I think we're seeing it in the public domain as well, is that because we're spending more time on our own in our homes, we don't have the kind of casual conversations where things get sorted out, where we come up, spark new ideas, we get the creativity. And I think that those less structured conversations are just so important to just the smooth running of whether it's a university, whether it's a company, whether it's society, having those kind of casual face-to-face conversations. And I think a lot of the challenges that we see, whether it's in universities or, as I say, whether it's in like public discourse, is because we're just not spending enough time with people. I think so often now people don't really think through the best way to how to get the most out of it when you get people together in the same space. So often people will organize these massive conferences at huge expense, whether it's just the cost of the venue and everything like that, everybody's travel, everybody coming together in the same space, and then you'll have a 10-minute coffee break. And that's not enough time to have proper conversations. People come away from conferences and say, you say, what did you get out of it? And they'll be like, well, the most important, the most valuable things were the connections, the people, the conversations we had over coffee. But we don't give them space. We don't structure networking. We don't help people to find other people that they might be interested in connecting with. I recently got sent a delegate list before an event and I was like, this is such a gift. It's so long since somebody sent me a delegate list. So I could look beforehand and think, who did I want to talk to? And I could do things like go online and remind myself of what they looked like so that when we got to the event, I could actually find them in the crowd of people. And so we're going through the motions of some of these things, but not actually creating the spaces where people can have those conversations, where they really could make a difference and actually be really valuable. And so doing conferences better, doing meetings better, making the most of that time that we actually get to be together face to face. And that's why I call it gathering with purpose, because it's how do we think through what we want to get out of those experiences so that we can have the best of both worlds, so that we can have the hybrid working and the working from home and the online meetings when that's the right thing. But when we are together in a space, how we can do that well too.
Yeah, that's interesting. In one of the professional organisations that I'm involved with, I've just stepped off the steering committee, and some of the big tasks of the steering committee over the last couple of years is thinking about how can we reshape our big main conference that gets about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people and increasing numbers to be more about conferring.
Yeah, the conference. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, yeah.
which is what you're talking about how do we create the spaces for people to connect, to talk, to share ideas, and not just sit in a blah, blah fest the whole time where people present papers unsatisfactorily because we have more papers, shorter times, less time for discussion. And why are we bringing people together?
Yeah, and I think so much of it is like when you're talking, I totally get it, because when you're talking about a conference that it's the scale of like 3,000, 4,000 people, no doubt it's outsourced to a conference management company. And the conference management company will have a template and they're like, this is our template. We do it this way. You do. And it's only because it's easier for them. So they'll have, you know, the structure and you put the talks in here and then you, everybody does their posters and their abstracts and all this work that's going in as well. That nobody's really, so people are not paying attention in the talks because it's too much information all at once. Nobody's reading the posters because the writing is like this tiny, but people have put so much work into them. It makes me really sad.
So what are some of the things that you've tried that have really worked well in promoting conversation? And I loved just the simple act of sending out a delegate list. Like that's such a small effort. I mean, I guess it's not because you've got to pull it together, but it's relatively small effort with a big potential payoff. And what might be some other things?
I think some of the things are so small that just, you know, it's we're not talking huge game changers. If you just took all the coffee breaks and made them longer, that in and of itself is something. I'm doing a little bit of structured networking. Now, I know a lot of people, they'll hear things like that and be like, and have like a reaction and think of like speak networking and things like that. There's ways of doing it which make it feel fun and make it feel inclusive and get people to just talk to lots of different people. But rather than just trusting that somehow people will magically find the person to talk to, actually maybe there's little things you could do, like you could like buddy somebody up with somebody they've not met before, you know. There's lots of little ways of doing it. So thinking more, I think the main thing for me is thinking more about how, so people always think about preparing the speakers and preparing the posters, and there's a lot of work goes into that. They get lots of briefing. Very little thought goes into preparing the participants for how they show up in the space. And as I say, that's when it's things like sending out, and I mean, I know people say, oh, like GDPR and everything. You don't need to send out everybody's contact details if you send out a delegate list. You can just literally send a list of people or names. Or you can do just how often have you just had like one email, massive email that just says, here's all the information and the parking and the like, you know, here's like all of this stuff. And it's all about logistics. And none of it is about what it means to be in that space as a member of the audience, as a contributor. And I think there's a lot could be done there that, you know, just doing things like, oh, I'm a big fan of things like drip feeding information. You don't just send one big email, or you send some little snippets beforehand, or maybe you set up like a little online thing where people can introduce themselves or share a bit of information beforehand. And I know people are busy. That's one of the reasons why drip feeding information works, is because people are busy. So you give them a little bit at a time so they remember that they're coming and they get a little bit. But so it's not necessarily about making people feel like they've got a whole other job to do before that, and they just want to go and sit. But I think that being a bit more respectful of people's time.
I'd never ever thought about preparing the participants to engage and contribute.
People just don't. They just, they just assume people know what to do. And some maybe do, but then that's where you end up in situations as well, where thinking through, power dynamics is a big thing for me in a lot of the spaces I work in as well. And when you're doing things like engagement workshops with, say, you've got academics and people with lived experience of a particular illness, which is one project I'm working on at the moment. And you have to think a lot about power dynamics in those situations and how you're going to balance out. But they're at play in meetings and conference situations as well. You know, it's like you say, not enough time for discussion. And you'll have this Q&A session where the only people who put their hands up are a few kind of really senior, usually senior, or people who like colleagues of the person who's presented or something, because people don't want to look like an idiot by asking something that comes out wrong in front of, you know, a huge crowd of people and potentially the people who might give them their next job. So I think managing some of that as well would really help people to participate, thinking a bit about power dynamics as well. Yeah.
I can see how you would add so much value to thinking about event planning, whether it's a smaller group or a bigger conference.
Yeah. Thank you. I just think it's years and years of experience. And it's the kind of thing that people think if you put that putting on an event is just you book a room and you book some catering and you get a speaker or something, and then everything else takes care of itself. And yes, on one level, that kind of works. But if you want to do something that's really worthwhile, it just needs more thought. Yeah.
It's your gathering with purpose. It's the purpose bit, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I have to confess that I had just thought about, you know, the event work as being more of the logistics, because it is the work that has to be done.
It absolutely has to be done. What makes the difference, where the
value comes is, the gathering.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sure you have similarly novel insights around the communication side, because again, like, you just have so many years of experience. And again, your thing about your catchline about great research needs to be shared. We're trained in sharing via our academic papers, but not else.
No. And I mean, I think this is something that, again, that's kind of where I started, is doing that communication piece. So that is, there's loads and loads of advice and things out there. I mean, I'm sure I could point people towards stuff if they want. But some of the key things that I always say to people, if you want to do communication better of research, is the first thing is to understand who you're doing it for. And it's the same with the events as well. You know, the purpose. What do you want to get out of it? Who is this for? What is the message you're trying to get across to them? So think about who it's for. And because that will determine the language that you use, what's appropriate. It will determine the format that you use. So whether it's, obviously, you know, if you want to talk to five-year-olds, the format isn't going to be an academic research paper. You know, it's maybe going to be a story, or it's going to be a little kind of hands-on activity. And it's, so once you know who it's for, you know the language, you know what's going to be a good format to use, you know where to put it so that the people are going to find it.
That's a good point.
As well, because so often people will do now, something that I find really frustrating is people, like, they'll spend thousands of pounds. And I know people who create videos and animations and they're amazing. So I'm not in any way dissing the work they do, because they do fantastic stuff. Yeah. But the people who've commissioned it don't think about what they're going to do with it. So they create this video and then they just stick it on YouTube. And then they're surprised that they don't get much of a return on investment for this, you know, £3,000 or whatever they spent on the animation. And so it's thinking it through in terms of how it fits with the structure as well, and how you're going to actually take that information, those assets, and use them. Where are you going to put them? How are people going to find them? Because not many people are casually browsing the internet looking for research on whatever obscure French philosopher or whatever it is that people are working on. So you've got to put it in front of people. You've got to put it where they're going to find it, and in a format that they're going to understand it and engage with it. And that's the top level. But there's so much nuance in there, depending on who the audience are and how you want to reach them and what you want to communicate with them about.
So that's almost like sharing with purpose.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's a different angle on it. It's really, I love it. Yeah. So I'm conscious that it's after the time that we had said. Okay. Is there anything that you've wanted to share that we haven't talked about yet that you'd want people to think about or know about?
Oh, goodness me. I mean, I think that, if what you've heard is interesting, if you're interested in research careers and opportunities, beyond academia, as it were, then yeah, do go and have a listen to Research Adjacent. There's now an archive. It's not quite as big as your archive, Geraldine, but there is 82, 83 episodes at the time of recording sitting there that you can dive through, and there are, you can filter it based on things like, you know, those four categories that I was saying before, that four types of jobs, you can filter on that and hopefully find somebody who gives a little bit of inspiration for career opportunities that might be possible there. And then if you're interested in the other work I do, the events and the communication side of things, then yeah, come, you can subscribe to, I've got a newsletter called Gathering with Purpose, which you can subscribe to. I hang out on LinkedIn, so you can find me there. The spelling of my surname is usually the thing that trips people up, but I'm sure we can put a link in the show notes. So
I'll put a link to all of those.
Yeah.
Well, as I said at the beginning, Sarah, I think you're an amazing advocate for the possibilities that are opening up. And I hope it makes people feel excited about what the options are, and also a role model in how to find your own path through that as well, and connecting to what lights you up and, you know, yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. And yeah, as I say, even with the role model thing, just if people know, we're all still just figuring it out and taking the next right step, and everybody's winging it to some extent. So
yeah. I think that's a lovely thing to remind people of, because we are, so you said you're in your 50s and I'm in my 60s, and I still feel like I'm winging it. I also have never had a 10-year plan or anything. Yeah. And stuff, I mean, I guess it's easier at this end of the career to look back and say stuff does have a way of working out.
It does. It does. It's
being true to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And wish people the best of luck with whatever they're doing.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Geraldine.
So that's the end of my conversation with Sarah. Inspiring in so many ways. If you want to find out more about Sarah, her website is sarahmccluskey.com. And just to do the spelling of McCluskey, it's McLusky. And the podcast you can find at researchadjacent.com. And I'd highly recommend that, especially if you're starting to think about some different types of career paths, career possibilities. You can find the summary notes, a transcript, and related links for this podcast on www.changingacademiclife.com. You can also subscribe to Changing Academic Life on iTunes, Spotify, and I'm really hoping that we can widen the conversation about how we can do academia differently. And you can contribute to this by rating the podcast and also giving feedback. And if something connected with you, please consider sharing this podcast with your colleagues. Together, we can make change happen.